the U.S. government is breaking into other organizations for espionage purposes, but not for economic advantage in the way that China is doing it. China could argue it's a, you know, minor difference, but in the U.S., I think we see it as a much more substantial difference because it's creating, again, these unfair advantages that China is exploiting.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast with me, Jerry Perullo, Sunil Yu, and Mario Duarte. Today we're going to cover a number of pressing topics. We're going to talk a little bit about whether the U.S. is hacking China back and how you should feel about that, whether China's hacking Taiwan. We're going to talk about browser extension risks, which seem to keep on coming up. And we're going to see if denial of service is coming back. Going back to passkeys and usability, and finally, we're going to go through some organizational behavior and what it's like to be a CISO managing talent today. So let's just get right into it, guys. Good to see you. It's Snowmageddon 2.0 here in Atlanta, which you might see a little bit of in the background, but we're still at it.
My thoughts go out to all the folks in Los Angeles. I'm sure they would prefer the snow than what they're facing now. So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, totally good point.
I'm echoing Sunil's sentiment. Please, everybody, stay safe. And very difficult times right now. We actually had a minor earthquake in San Francisco this morning. So seems like things are not. There's any correlation going on here, but it's interesting, nevertheless.
Yeah, there's more to risk management than adversarial risk management. Jumping on in here, one of the things that that caught our eye was this story. It was a Reuters post about the Chinese National Cyber Center issuing a report about U.S. Interest stealing trade secrets from tech firms, which is kind of the headline we've been hearing in reverse here in the States for a long time. And in parallel to that, I kicked off the semester with my class at Georgia Tech. And one of the first things that I threw in to talk about a little bit was that National Security Group of Taiwan put out a report about how much China was hacking. Going back to the first one, I think a lot of people in our listenership, especially U.S.-based, Western-based, hear that and feel like, oh, it's about time. Is it right for state agencies to support the private sector through hacking efforts? Do you think that's happening in this direction? Should people feel good about it if it's true?
Yeah, well, so first of all, espionage versus economic theft mm-hmm. are two different things, right? I don't think China necessarily differentiates between the two, whereas I think in the U.S. we absolutely do. So in the context of the U.S. government breaking into various entities around the world, not just Chinese, but you know entities in around the world, what can the U.S. government do once they steal these trade secrets? Let's just be clear. It's actually illegal for the U.S. government to provide that to a commercial entity because it's giving them an unfair advantage. And this is something that that China absolutely does. Well, you can argue that China is making this statement and making a big fuss about it just to say, hey, look, you guys are doing this too. But no, actually, we're doing it in a wholly different way. Yes, we are. The U.S. government is breaking into other organizations for espionage purposes, but not for economic advantage in the way that China is doing it. China could argue it's a minor difference, but we see it as a, in the U.S., I think we see it as a much more substantial difference because it's creating, again, these unfair advantages that China is exploiting.
Yeah, you know, this kind of has this... this oblique adjacency to a topic that I remember coming up a long time ago. When I first started in information security, there was a whole lot more talk about cross-commercial hacking threats, like, and this is entirely hypothetical, but, oh, is Goldman Sachs going to be hacking JP Morgan's investment bank to see their algos? And there was this assumption that that's what's going on among a lot of executives that were new to cybersecurity. Like, oh, we need to be protecting from our competitors. And I, at first, you know, you kind of go with it, but I had a hunch, and over time, it's proving a negative, but I always as much as you could, prove the negative, and found that, and concluded that that's not going on. Like, it's just, how do you account for that on the budget? How do you present that to the board in your annual report? How do you show how much money you spent hacking other companies and stealing the data? And I ultimately said, like, let's stand down on that. There's more to lose than possibly to gain from that sort of thing. And I guess that's what this fits into when, per what you're saying, the intelligence agencies would be breaching U.S. law, right, by disclosing even Chinese competitor data to a U.S. domestic corporation. Is that right?
Yeah. There are cases where if we discover a trade secret that actually belongs to a U.S. company, then guess what happened? We tell the U.S. company, let's say like a Cisco, guess what? There's this company called Huawei that we think stole your secrets. you might have been breached, right? Mm-hmm. So those are cases where we're not giving Cisco an advantage, right, because it was their code to begin with, but they do get awareness that, hey, they've been breached as well. But let's take it to another level. This is a thought exercise for a moment, and it's worth considering this. As we all know, China is investing heavily into AI and trying to become dominant in the AI space. Let's suppose that through espionage techniques, we discover, the U.S. government discovers some really, really important secret, trade secret that we would want to capitalize on. You can imagine the kind of interesting discussions that may happen in terms of what do we do with this, because it's not, we can't just give it to OpenAI, we can't give it to Anthropic, we can't give it to Google. That's again illegal. And so how can we avoid technological surprise but gain a technological advantage? It's an interesting debate. We haven't run into many situations where other countries have had a technological advantage over us.
I guess the distinction comes between whether it's possible to help your entire domestic ecosystem versus are you helping one chosen favored player, which is a clear problem there. And I can imagine that, you know, people with a more nationalistic or America first bent would immediately rally to, yeah, we should be helping U.S. corporations gain a competitive advantage. We should be hacking China. We should be stealing IP and giving it to corporations. I bet even those folks would pause when you pointed out, which one do you give it to? That said, I wonder if we're going to see more of a clamoring for this, or if we're going to run into any of these issues moving forward.
Especially if we're finding ourselves at a technological disadvantage because we don't put enough investment or whatever it might be.
When I looked at this, there's two things that stood out for me. Well, I mean, the initial one was look at the pot calling the kettle black, right? Wow. And so I realized, just thinking about that, is, you know, the Chinese government is leaning in on a global campaign to, one, make themselves look better and make the United States look worse. So this is, I see this as part of that campaign, that global campaign to do that. From a more technical perspective, this reminds me, I was thinking about as we were looking into deploying our own application in China, you know, one, interviewing the talent that we were going to hire, but also understanding the security requirements that the Chinese government mandates for their companies in China. And I found him, in all sincerity, not to be at the same level of security expertise that their American or European companies' counterparts. And to me, it feels, when I looked into this, that you might have a hard shell, the Chinese firewall that they call, but inside is pretty Swiss cheese. It's very easy once you're in there to really compromise these companies. It doesn't surprise me in all sincerity.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I mean, as much as it pains us to think about how vulnerable commercial assets have been in the United States for so long due to our completely transparent internet, it's probably hardened the country and our infrastructure quite a bit. And if you think that during a wartime situation, you got to throw away the perimeter and assume that the nation state level adversaries are operating through that very quickly and easily, for the U.S., that doesn't make much of a difference. You know, attack me from Jersey or from Guangzhou, it doesn't really make a difference. But you turn that around on China, and it makes a huge difference. There's probably a shit ton of wind nuke that can take down a lot of machines really quick once you're anywhere in terrestrial China, I would guess.
Ah. Yeah, keep in mind a lot of the bad actors are actually prohibited from attacking certain countries because of their sponsorship, right? So to your point, they're not getting the same kind of robust treatment that we are getting.
Yeah, the trial, the battle hardening. Yeah, on the related note about Taiwan, what I wanted to point out there was the story Taiwan published of a report. It's an annual report. It was very brief, and I don't know if it was just because they rushed it out in English too, or what it was, because it was an English report. It said, we are attacked by China, by PRC, approximately 2.4 million times a day. And it didn't give much more color on what constitutes and what defines an attack. In the same article, it went on to say there are less than 1,000, I think it was 600 or 700 cases of cyber attack from China per day. And so for my students, as I was sharing that, what I was trying to demonstrate is that these numbers that come out, when I see 2.4 million attacks per day, to me that's like dropped packets. And I once published this study in the, it was in the FSISAC Intel sharing list, where I showed something just like that. It was in the order of tens of thousands of attacks per day. It had provenance in China and Russia and a few other places. And I went on and I talked about it being the MMR entity that was being attacked and on. And after going through some details and going through the metrics, I said it was my mom's router. So I was home for over the holidays, and I took my mom's Linksys 45 router that I had installed on their cable modem years prior, and I found a little OS version to let you syslog, and I sent it to, I think it was Sumo Logic, and did a little freebie demo, jammed all the data in, ran some geo-reporting. And the point was, if you're on the internet, you get a bunch of packets. And you drop them.
Totally.
These stats are useless, right?
First thing that I thought about this was Taiwan's government needs a lot of help. If they can only think they're only getting 2.4 million attacks a day from China, boy, we got problems, Taiwan. Seriously.
Packets, you should
say. My grandma on a wheelchair has more attacks on the day one of putting her laptop out there, okay?
Well, so let me see if I can guess. There's a corresponding metric that follows this 2.4 million attacks a day that also says, "Hey, we've blocked 100% of those." So, I've actually seen such reporting. It's kind of funny.
Absolutely.
There are a couple things to note here, though. Obviously, the definition of an attack, you know, aside, we should anticipate that if you're Israel, or rather, if you're Iran, most of your attacks are going to be directed against Israel. If you're Russia, most of your attacks are going to be directed against Ukraine. If you're China, most of your attacks are going to be directed against Taiwan. And not only that, but you're going to actually probably put some of your best stuff against them. So one perspective in that regard is, if you as a U.S. company are concerned about Chinese-based attacks, then what is it that we can learn from Taiwanese companies, or maybe even I would just say Taiwanese cybersecurity companies, right? I'd be curious if any of our listeners or you guys know of a Taiwanese specific, like Taiwan based cybersecurity company, okay? Let's say one that does EDR. Anyone?
No.
Well, there's a company called CyCraft, CyCraft. CyCraft, Taiwanese based, they're an EDR company. I would bet you, this is a conjecture, but you know, I would think that the numbers should speak for themselves. They're one of the main providers of EDR software in Taiwan, and I would wonder and probably bet that they have better detection rules than CrowdStrike would, right? Because they're just seeing a lot more of Chinese based attacks. And so if I wanted to defend against China, I wouldn't necessarily just buy CyCraft just for that. But it's just to recognize that there's regional expertise because of the nature of who they're seeing on our day-to-day basis.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, without a doubt. I'll tell you, I think that, like, getting back to the metrics on this, I'm thinking through it. I think psychologically, the reason why they published 2.4 million, why Jamie Dimon said a billion attacks per day, I'm pretty sure it was him, it was somewhere up in JP Morgan on an interview, or why when one of my students came back and said, oh yeah, there's a Pentagon report that says the U.S. is seeing 36 million attacks per month, that the Pentagon is seeing 36 million attacks. I think, and what we just said was that those stats are all pointless. I think the reason is that if you have a castle gate in medieval times and you have a million people hit it with a battering ram, it's going to fall at some point. There's an aggregation, you know, element to kinetic attacks. There's not in cyber, and that's what people don't get. And so you're appealing emotionally to people who work in that kinetic thought process. And in reality, if the first one didn't work, the 2.4 millionth isn't going to work either, unless you're talking about distributed denial of service and that sort of thing. We're not here. So I guess it's just another example of the paradigmatic thought process shift people have to go through to really work in this space.
We waste so much time on patching and going, and where it's not really going to be the thing that's going to break us necessarily, but we are wasting cycles. So even though some of these attacks that we're seeing, if you spend too much time chasing these attacks that are coming from the public internet that really don't apply to you, and if you're chasing them, you're wasting valuable resources for the real attacks to get by.
Yeah, that's true.
It does beg the question then, what's a better metric, right? And I think this is where Lockheed's kill chain approach ended up being a potentially a better metric around not how many level one alerts did we get, like level one meaning, you know, stage one in the kill chain, but how far, what were the numbers as you went down the kill chain? And if you were able to stop a significant number of step six in the kill chain attacks, well, that's pretty good, right? Or the fact that they got that far is should be of concern, but that you've also stopped them is also, you know, kudos to you as well. But anyway, the perspective here is we know that this type of metric sucks. It's not a really great metric, but understanding how far an attacker got in and what we were able to do to stop them before they got complete their objectives, that's in the end a better metric.
Yeah, I think what this goes to that I see in the private sector a lot, and it's something in a class topic again, is incident classification and SEV levels, even within a firm. So, like, I have this whole religion about its severity level definitions and one way to do it. But what I always tell people is it's not that my way is a better way or the only way, but it's just that we all, to have a meaningful conversation, need to agree on a way, meaning definitions. What's SEV 5? What's SEV 4? What's SEV 3? Because then you could get into the, we experienced 1,000 SEV 3 attacks, and everyone actually would know what that means. And the kill chain is totally plausible. I think the Lockheed Martin kill chain is not super useful today. I think the folks who created it would agree, you know, because of things like weaponization of documents and like, but the notion of like, I use a compressed version that's more layman appealing or like four steps, that's good. And you're right, like knocking on the door is very different from RCE, being on the LAN, you know, actually getting data out, those types of things. So for a given organization, I think the takeaway is they need to all agree during peacetime early on what the thresholds are for different levels of severity before they can even think about sharing meaningful metrics. All right, moving on. It seems like we should have a Chrome extension or just a browser extension segment of the show because we hit it so often. Since our last show, Cyberhaven, which is a cybersecurity vendor whose technology and approach relied pretty heavily on browser extensions to good effect. And as I remember, this is almost like an enterprise browser via extension, which is sexy and kind of cool when I first heard about it. But it also means that you're deploying third-party software into the browsers of all of your users. And boom, theirs got popped. And then as we pulled on the thread in the story, it turns out it wasn't Cyberhaven alone or necessarily that it was targeted, but rather that someone came up with a playbook of, wow, I can get into extensions, which is privileged software. And there's like 30-plus of them, right? Yeah, what can we take away from this? Should people be doing anything as a result of this story?
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting takeaway was the means by which the attacker actually got access to the extension in the web store. So when Cyberhaven first released some update about it, they said, hey, the attacker compromised a developer's credentials, and this is how they get in. But actually, they didn't compromise the credentials. They compromised access. And I want to make sure that there's the distinction here. The user's credentials were never actually stolen. Rather, the user authorized access through basically an OAuth, sort of like an impersonation attack, where the attacker said, "Hey, your extension is that you've published is violating some policy. Click here to review the policy." You review the policy, but when you click on the button to review the policy, you see this OAuth permission grant to seemingly gain access to read the policy. And it looks totally legit, totally. The screen itself is legit because it's coming from Google itself.
Would you have fallen
for
it? You
hit allow.
That's a tough question.
I would have.
You know you're coming next, Mario. Yeah, get ready. Would you have fallen for it?
It was a very convincing attack. Would I have fallen for it? On a sleepless, if I had very little sleep and wasn't fully awake, I would have fallen for it.
And if you're an extension author, right? Okay, let's set that in there too, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, because it was very plausible. Like, hey, you're violating some policy. Okay, I need to go look at it and see what's going on. And I click and boom, something, you know, I don't notice, right? But anyway, that's it. The perspective here was it wasn't a credential attack. It was an access attack. And what we should expect is as we implement more MFA, as we do passkey and all these other sort of things, attackers are going to find clever and wily ways to still gain access without ever compromising credentials.
Yeah, it's a little scary.
So many different things. First of all, as we all, you know, belong to a lot of these CISO communities, I remember I've used Cyberhaven. We used Cyberhaven before, and I like the company. I think it's a good company. But the community was like, who's Cyberhaven? What's going on? So it was a kind of a good advertisement in some ways for a lot of the CISO community. I thought, yeah, maybe you, Sunil, Gary, tell me how you feel, but I thought Cyberhaven, I don't have any money. I'm disclosing this. I don't have no investment in these guys. But I thought they handled it pretty well. They were pretty upfront. They communicated, you know, quickly and provided updates. And so good kudos for them. Okay, kudos for them. And then on this whole extension and this type of attacks, Sunil's right on. This is what's coming. It's going to become more prevalent. Here's my advice for everyone. If you're going to receive one of these things through your phone, step back. Don't click on it. Take a deep breath. Maybe look at it through your laptop. And maybe in your laptop, as you take your time, you might be able to see that although it looks like it's Google underneath, it's definitely not the right URL. Anyway, just my advice is it's really hard to look at these things when you have a small screen like on your phone and you're busy and you're doing multiple things. You're going to fall for it, okay?
Yeah.
Take a step back. Do a 10-second count. If they're using emotion to emotional, eliciting an emotion from you, understand what that emotion is.
Yeah.
10 seconds. 10-second rules before you click.
Yeah, it's tough. It's rough out there. All right, next thing. Interesting story out of Krebs on Security, about the arrest of a 20-year-old Army soldier who was in Korea at the time, if I remember right, or at least he served there for a long time, of being this pseudonym that was involved in the Snowflake hacks, I believe, but and selling data earlier from AT&T and Verizon. You know, when I look through the story to a security person, this doesn't really mean anything on action to take or, you know, the end game or threat intel or control positioning and nothing like that. To me, it's an OSINT story. I'm sorry, an OPSEC story about this guy's OPSEC and kind of he shouldn't have, it's so obvious to find him because of this, that, and the other. Is that how you guys read the story as well, or was there anything that hit home?
Well, actually, so it wasn't the person actually had really good OPSEC, actually. They made one small mistake. Well, they made two mistakes. One small mistake, that was the OPSEC one, and the bigger mistake was threatening Allison Nixon, who's a bona fide OSINT researcher. So it's like saying, I mean, it's just like that's just stupid, right? You wanna get caught, you threaten one of the best out there, in doing OSINT, and there you go, right? So the other perspective I would offer, and, you know, I think as we hear more about the who are the actual people behind these attacks, it's starting to recalibrate for me our expectations around different classes of attackers and what they're really capable of. I use this rubric that that I got from Anthony Johnson. He defines four levels of attackers: Joey, Joe, Joseph, and Yosef. And the investments that we put in to address each of those is slightly different. In some cases, like, for example, Yosef, you know, look, even if you're a nation state level target, you may not, there's very few people who would be able to defend against a Yosef, right? But the vast majority of us are expected to be able to at least handle a Joey or a Joe, okay? And we're trying to build competency for a Joseph, which is more like the criminal organized attacker type of profile. So the question here is this guy more like a Joey or Joe? In which case, you know, are we even able to do the basics, so to speak? Like, how if the capability of these Joeys and Joes are getting better and better, it really forces us to step our game up as well and not necessarily treat them as the script kiddies that we used to in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll see what comes of that, but maybe it helps out a little bit with the people who are victimized in getting some comeuppance. Totally different topic here, potentially very technical one. So there was a story that came out in Wired magazine, which I usually find is good news. It means that someone's put a lot of research into something and you're going to get some really great detail out of it. And this one in particular was about a trove of geodata getting popped by a threat actor and shared. But it also, in that trove of data, it said, you know, here's a location coordinate. I think it had an IP address. And whether or not it even had an individual name, I'm not sure of, but that wasn't the point here. But it did say what app it came from, or came with, I should say, because we're talking about like SDKs that are bundled with apps. And what it brought to light, and I think Wired did a good job of sharing, is that there's a lot more location data culling that there are collecting that's going on in apps that you wouldn't think would care about your location data whatsoever. And a lot of times it's for marketing purposes, and it's shared through marketing agencies for use for correlated advertising. And here is a pretty good example of a... It's not the privacy risk around the marketer or around the core app publisher, but just the fact that this data is getting aggregated somewhere makes it a target and increases the risk that someone's going to come across it, pop it, subpoena it, in any other way get access to it. Has this been going on a long time? Is this bringing something? Is this something everybody should go out and read this article, or is this common knowledge and obvious?
Well, one of the things I would say is welcome to the ad tech ecosystem. There's this ecosystem is highly tuned for the purposes of precision targeting, and I'm actually surprised that we haven't seen more precision targeting than, well, maybe it's happening and we just don't know. And the reason why we don't know is because it's precision targeting. So imagine, if you will, I wanted to deliver a certain class of ads to, talking about a previous story, let's say I wanted to deliver a certain class of ads to males ages 25 to 35 with a background of mathematics who lives near Columbia, Maryland. Okay. That's, you know, it's a very specific demographic I'm shooting for. And if you're a threat intel researcher, you would never see that because you don't fit that demographic. So anyway, that's something to the whole ad tech ecosystem and its ability to do this fine-tuned targeting is amazing, and that's what they're geared to do. And so as a part of that, the location tracking and all that kind of stuff that we're seeing, there's a lot more than just location tracking that's happening here that helps us understand exactly what our habits are. And so that's something to it's worse than you think is the way I would describe it, first of all. And then the other perspective I would offer is with AI, the ability to mine through this is going to become much more trivial than it used to be in the past. Mm. Before, you'd have to spend more time and pay attention to you had to divide up your time. But going forward, I don't think you have to make as many trade-offs because you can leverage a lot more automation to sift through mountains of this and target a lot more people at scale.
Well, talk about the worst case scenario here. Like, what are people worried about? So, I mean, through this data, even if it was super enriched, can I figure out where Sunil is? Probably just look you up in the phone book, right? So, what should people be worried about?
Well, the way I would describe the worry here is to use a different analogy that we've all are familiar with. So, if the three of us were in a forest and a bear was chasing after us. The goal is not to outrun the bear. The goal is to outrun one of you guys, right? Okay, so that is a human scale way of thinking about the problem. We just need to be better than our neighbor because the bear will catch them and waste time on them. The reality of capabilities, the data that's being spilled and the capabilities that are emerging is we'll have many bears and we'll have our own specific bear for just us.
You know, Sunil, I was just on a bike ride earlier this week, and I said the same thing, and I looked at everybody. I said, but I'm the slowest one here.
I doubt
so
that.
I am
you must have been
some
real baller.
I'm going to get caught by the bear. Look, folks, you know, news headlines here. We have been the honey for all these companies, tech companies, forever. We are when you think of using some of these services that one either you're not paying for or you're paying very little for, well, guess what they're doing with that information? Guess what they're doing with how you interact with those services? Well, they're reselling it to marketing folks. This is the whole tech industry, quite honestly, at least the software tech industry, and how it's been able to fund itself for all these years. Think of Facebook as an example, Google. Why do you think they're making billions and billions of dollars? Since they've been doing this forever. And by the way, we're not going to be able to put it back in. This is reality. Hmm. Get used to it.
Yeah, so privacy is dead. Privacy is over.
I think there's. I applaud the efforts of Apple to create a premium product from which part of the premium that we're paying for is to have some semblance of privacy, or at least our awareness of where we're giving up our privacy. I don't know if the battle is completely dead, at least for our children or our children's children, maybe you can offer a better world. I think for privacy for the three of us, you know, I mean, we're out there on the public internet, so we have no privacy.
I was showing my wife yesterday the chat. I finally jumping in this ChatGPT, and I hate using these tools, right? Because I get hooked on them. And so I was showing my wife, hey, check this out. Planning our schedule, our vacation, and what we should be doing. And sure enough, it's recommending all these different restaurants, all these different places to go visit. Think about it, folks. Think about how they're recommending these places to us and these places to go visit. It doesn't happen magically. There's an economics perspective behind it.
All right, denial of service. Let's talk about denial of service. Is it back? I spent a big chunk of my career, I wouldn't say a big chunk, defending a denial of service. I will tell you there was a time that, like everyone, we thought about denial of service and whether we should do anything about it and thought we had protections. But then I managed to live through a lot of concerted, high volume, someone's really trying hard, DDoS, and you know, took it on the chin a few times, took some impact, figured it out, won at the end of the day, and we learned how to survive these and do well, and then for years we're able to laugh it off and report that someone was trying. So these days it seems kind of commoditized, DDoS protection. The CDNs, the content delivery networks, are generally offering the protection, and for other reasons everyone's on a CDN these days anyway, so it's helped. But what about single D? DOS, denial of service without the distributed part of it. A couple of CVEs came out about denial of service vulnerabilities, and it was a Palo Alto product and Microsoft Windows Active Directory. We were chatting about Mario, and what you raised right away is that it's hard to spot these things through things like a bounty program that are so awesome at insecure direct object reference and SQL injection, all these other important critical things. It's hard to find these because you're not allowed to test for DOS. for obvious reasons. Nobody wants you to take down the site. Is that true? And are there a lot of other DOS CVEs waiting out there because of the fact that we can't even try for them?
Keep in mind, you know, back in July of 2024, we all had an interesting opportunity to see how resilient we were to a single denial of service attack that affected several systems. And some did it well and others didn't. And I think part of the reason why I bring this up is, and why I think denial of service nowadays should be a nothing burger, is that the loss of a system, the denial of the outage of a given system, even at large scale, it should be something that people should be prepared for, especially for critical business systems. So if you lose a system, or if you don't have the resiliency to handle a denial of service attack of some sort, then that's really kind of on you and not on the vendor or whoever else it might be. And I'll say, you know, to Jerry's point about our history of denial of service, you didn't work for what a certain country thought was the central bank of the United States, right? So we had quite an interesting time getting denial of service attacks against us just because of the name and the symbolic references to the U.S. So that was an interesting time for sure. But I think at the end of the day, we ended up becoming much more resilient, and the infrastructure as a whole became much more resilient, which is the lesson to be learned, right? If you don't, to me, denial of service should be like, who cares? Not because, and it shouldn't, it's not a, I understand why it's not a bug bounty issue because we don't want to destabilize the system. But I would also just say, okay, so what, you denial of service system, I can boot it right back up and, or even boot up a different parallel system and be on my way. I would say it's a low value type of attack nowadays.
It's tough, though. I mean, technically, like, the solutions to this are things like, because we're not talking about DDoS here, right? We're talking about single devices. The solutions are high availability. And, I mean, I've been down this road a lot where it's, you know, when you're just growing up, so to speak, you buy a firewall. And then when you're an enterprise, you buy a pair of firewalls. And then you buy another pair for your disaster recovery site and then the tertiary site. Like, you kind of grow into that. And I teach in class, like, security people don't deploy security hardware. Ops does, because they think about change control and HA and all that kind of stuff. And security should be rightfully set the policy and move on to the next battle. And I think that's true. But HA, and you buy it and you pay a lot of money for it to have high availability, double hardware. And it works when someone trips over the power cable in the data center or controlled type things. But this stuff, these unique application level race conditions or whatever it is, often don't trigger the HA. I can't tell how many times it was, how the hell is that down? We had HA. Oh, the primary is still saying that it's okay, even though it can't process packets or that sort of thing. So I think it is still hard. And how do you find that? In other words, I don't think that's just on companies to be able to expect them to live past that. But should, and at the same time, I can't light up bounty hunters and say, try denial of service at X2 are awfully curious, unless maybe I put them in a staging environment or something. So maybe there are a ton of these things that are out there. Magic packet attacks, right? That's what we're talking about.
There's just no economic incentive for this stuff. I always go back to the incentive, the economic incentives. Now, unless you're a hacktivist, okay? So this kind of, even though this is a DOS, not a DDoS, but it brings me back. I used to work at a company that was a competitor of AWS years ago, and every freaking month we would get like the monster DDoS attack on us. And this is to Sunil's point, is doing research on why and how to look at these attacks and why is it happening to you? What is it in your environment? And in my case, it turns out that one of my customers, which I ended up kicking out of the company because it was a persona non grata, was hosting generic Viagra. And it apparently pissed off some mobster in Russia that had, you know, basically something happened to them. And they had paid these hacktivists to constantly do this denial of service on anybody who was doing any hosting on this product. So I learned, to Sunil's point, you do a little research and find out what the hell is going on. Who is this guy? And sure enough, it was one of my customers. I was hosting it on behalf of their customer who was selling generic Viagra. So DOS, generic Viagra, that's the kind of stuff we're looking at.
Yeah, targeting.
Well, the general adage that I still hold to is if you're trying to defend yourself against a distributed attack, the best way to do it is to have a distributed service. Now, I know we're talking about, you know, single D denial service, but at the same time, it's the same answer. If you are concerned about maintaining service, then you have a distributed service. And I think the old design patterns that we have around these dual firewalls and HA mode and so on and so forth, ultimately it's pointing to a non-distributed service. And that's where your design flaw is from the very beginning.
On a related note to this, the other CVE was about, and this just goes back to this recurring theme I keep coming up with, of like to, Intel is basically news these days, and it's often sponsored research. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because security companies need to be doing this for us to find out about vulnerabilities, and they wouldn't unless they're getting some benefit, which is kind of likes and clicks. But the downside is that they play up anything that they find. And this one that came out about Windows LDAP, but it's really about Windows Active Directory. And it said in the write-up, like any server with internet access is vulnerable to this, which I kind of read as, you know, just about any of these things. So I dug into this one. I can't dig into all of them. I don't have the time. I'm pretty good, I'd say, on average at reading fast through technical pieces and knowing what to get to. And I'm just saying that because other people have even less time, in other words, to deal with this stuff. And I probably spent 20 minutes on it, 20 valuable minutes, and ultimately realized, because of my, you know, decades of experience and being able to make a mental network diagram and all of that, that, oh, you had to be able to hit this thing locally on the LAN. It's not anything anybody would have ever allowed inbound via internet. If you did, you probably had other problems. And so to me, if I were running an enterprise, I would see this, spend that 20 minutes and say, all right, everybody, calm down. Let's go wait till Monday morning. And then here's what we need to look for, and it's not boiling the ocean and onwards. I think the other 99% of security organizations are kind of screwed. Like, this is the life as in SecOps, is you get this email, it becomes a tweet. God forbid, I'm going to hammer on you, this, Sunil. God forbid Bank of America's TPRM department and the people they outsource to find out about it. Because now you're getting these questionnaires from your biggest customer. Have you found out about this? Have you evaluated your risk? And it's an arms race. It's a mess. And that's the CISO life, right? Being reactive and having to explain because someone published a headline all day, every day.
One of the things that I still dream for, and I first developed it when I was at Bank of America, and I was trying to see how you scale it. But the answer to your question is essentially, let's start with a threat model and understand our own threat model. Or if I'm, for example, selling something called Windows, to maybe even offer some semblance of a threat model for people who are using your product, so that when there's threat intelligence that comes out, the threat intelligence can actually map to the threat model, right? Mm-hmm. You really want to know whether this affects you or not. Well, the threat model should make it easy for us to make that decision. And unfortunately, we don't have, one, a consistent... Well, we don't have threat models. And two, most of us. Two, we don't have a consistent way to represent it, such that, three, when threat intelligence comes out, we can then map it to that threat model. The closest analogy we actually do have is the attack, MITRE attack framework, right? It's the closest thing that we have that says, here's some semblance of a threat... of a threat model. And what do we see now from some threat intelligence is here are the specific KTPs within the attack framework to help us know how it maps. It's not perfect, but it's a substantial step towards what I've been dreaming of, which is we all have these threat models and we can cross map it very quickly so that we know whether it affects us or not.
Yeah. This reminds me of a you hire pen test companies that come in and you let them in your network to do, you know, scan your environment, and then they exploit your RPC, right? Well, look, I got to gain access to your machine, your LDAP server, your AD server. But that But you already let them in. They already are in your network. Mm-hmm. This is not a protocol, to Jerry's point, that it's coming from the public, you're allowing from the public internet. And as to Jerry's point and Sunil's point, if you allow those things in, you got bigger problems, as Jerry said.
Yeah. You know what? We wrestled with this a lot. I think a lot of listeners will have wrestled with this, right? Where you spend $40,000 on a red team engagement. It's a good one. You're gonna have several weeks. You're gonna have dedicated people. You're gonna onboard them back when you actually had an office and somewhere to show up and all that kind of stuff. And you can give them backdoor access. So assume breach methodology. And then you're reading out the results, and the blue team are like over there grinding their teeth, like just ripping the armrests off, like, yeah, okay, they got to all that stuff, but you let them in as a sysadmin. Like, come on. And then they find out this report's go up to the board, and they're like, are you kidding me? We're going to look like total schmucks here. We're doing a great job. What do you expect? What we came up with, and I think this is a great idea. I haven't redrawn it in my new life in an elegant way, so someone else can run with this. But we made an XY matrix, like a heat map. And on the x-axis, we put how much damage they're able to do. Like, that's pretty obvious, kind of like the kill chain stuff Sunil was talking about earlier. And it started with, like, can they do some reconnaissance? And it ended with action on objective, right? Could they steal the data? We're worried about them stealing or shut down the systems. But the y-axis was really cool. And it was how much access did we have to give them? So, like, what role would they have to be in? And it ended with Holiday Inn. Meaning some random stranger in a Holiday Inn right now could accomplish this. And it began with sysadmin, right? And the along the spectrum, there was like an employee or a customer, an employee, a privileged employee.
That's pretty cool, Jerry. That's pretty cool.
It was super helpful, because when we went to the board, it was like this: the end of the world could have happened if they were a sysadmin, and people would immediately grok that. And be like, okay, that's not cool, but we're not negligent.
I like how you apply it to like real examples that people experience that are not necessarily cyber related.
I think. Yeah, I guess we have to, right? I mean, just.
I think the real people. So if you folks who know me know I'm a big cyber risk quantification advocate. Some others may disagree with
You're
that.
You're jabbing at me, aren't you?
to clarify, when I say risk quantification, I mean quantification in a language that the audience understands. Sometimes that audience understands numbers and money, and other times they understand Holiday Inn, right? Or like if you're in the hospitality industry, it's about guests or reservations and how many, if an event occurred, it would wreck 40,000 reservations. And that people understand that better than they may understand that better than, you know, $30 million or whatever else it might be, right? Big numbers sometimes don't really make sense to us than some other way to quantify risk in a way that directly relates to the business. And I think that's really the goal. And I think the effectiveness of the story that you just told was because people can relate to it.
Yeah, and exactly. And I think the simplification in general is helpful because you have a finite window to keep the audience ever. So if you can't deliver your punchline in 5 seconds, like in a boardroom or something like that, people tune out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think when you get some of these sensationalist headlines, its best recommendation is to, you know, update your executives that this is the nothing burger in a way that makes sense to them, and even talk to some of your board members that makes sense to them before that board member hears it from another company or another CISO that's talking about it as it's like the end of the world. I think, you know, it's in our best interest to inform and educate our people.
Yeah, I totally agree. I remember, I'm pretty sure it was the Bank of England who, as part of their, you know, examination rubric, their suggestions that you better do, was about delivering intel to the board. And at first I thought about how dumb that was. But in the end, it worked out pretty good. And we ended up choosing to deliver this corpus of stories to the board during every update. And it was cool. There were two buckets. And it was always, we came at this on our own. It was let's deliver to them headlines that are relevant to our threat profile and not just noise. And then the other was let's talk about the headlines that they're going to hear about anyway and explain why it's not relevant to our threat profile. All right, I love passkeys. I'm absolutely loving passkeys. I'm happy with them. A journalist wrote something about it's not usable. It's definitely not usable yet, which is sales. And I will agree with him that this matters and that usability is key, that without UX, that any new technology in authentication is not going to get off the ground. I hated PGP from very early days. I was one of the original founders of hating PGP. When I talk to customers today and set up a security.txt for vulnerability disclosure, there's something in the RFC that says you should put your PGP key. I tell them, hell no. The last thing you ever want is to get an encrypted packet from a hacker. Come on now. But I think passkeys are ready for prime time. Am I wrong?
Oh, I would love to see the adoption rate, first of all, because I think that's the real key as to whether it's truly ready for prime time. And we know we are, hopefully, the three of us are power users, so we probably run into more edge cases than our fair share. But I've run into a number of edge cases where I'm like, I don't even remember where this passkey is anymore, because I thought I put it onto this, and you know, so on and so forth. I think there is definitely still some rough edges that will make it far more usable, and you know, the article from Dan on Ars Technica I think highlights some of those. The at the end of the day, if it's going to be at scale, so many more people will find all those edge cases that we haven't discovered yet. That's going to just be frustrating. Moreover, as I mentioned earlier with the OAuth attack against Cyberhaven, this will just create, water has to flow somewhere. Electricity has to flow somewhere. It can't just stop. I'm actually very curious as to what the second order effects are from an attacker standpoint once passkeys become more prevalent. Because again, the water and electricity and crime has to go somewhere. And the nature of the attacks that we'll see may be undiscoverable, similar to what we saw with the Cyberhaven attack, until a cybersecurity vendor gets attacked themselves and they see it before anyone else does.
I give Dan kudos for doing the article and explaining some of the passkeys. But at the same token, I feel like people are just, you know, constantly complaining. On the one hand, they're like, we need to get rid of passwords. We're getting phished all the time, blah, blah, blah. And then you come out with something that's stronger and better. But now you're complaining that takes a little bit more effort. Oh, that you need something else to unify it. And then when you unify it, then you're going to, oh, my goodness, one vendor's controlling the entire framework. Come on, people. It's called progress. You know what? Right? If you don't want to deal with it, unplug and don't interact with the internet. If you want to interact with the internet, then learn. Take time to learn. Honestly, I don't have a lot of patience for people, especially in our industry. You folks, CISOs that are listening, learn about it. Use it. Start talking about it.
Yeah. You know, what we used to call this, and I know we didn't coin this phrase in our company, but it was a really hot one. Everybody's got their little colloquialisms in every company. Ours was, my boss in particular, was about not letting perfect become the enemy of good. And you know, that drives me to this day. It's exactly what you're talking about. It's like, yeah, it's not perfect. Hey, it's a hell of a lot better than where we were. Let's not abandon it. Let's go. Yeah, I agree. And, you know, a lot of the complaints in the article, he wasn't super whiny, but a lot of the questions in there were around key management, right, and where you put them. And everybody's trying to fool you. And I just logged in my Apple account earlier with passkey, and I was like, I wonder if this is going to be on my token or on. And I thought, oh, I know where this is going to be. It's Apple. Of course, it's going to be on the damn iCloud keychain. Of course, they forced it there, and I was right. But and then I've got ones that snuck their way into a Chrome keychain that I didn't even know existed. I didn't want to have existed, and that's all true. But at the end of the day, I'm logging into stuff without typing a password. So yeah, it's a hell of a lot better than it was last week.
I think to the point about it's on the keychain at iCloud, or like you see a lot of passwordless solutions basically using your email. It's basically pointing, it's moving the attack surface to something that hopefully is more safely guarded, right? Your iCloud account is going to be more safely guarded than a password that you put into some third-party website.
Yeah, text file that says password on your desktop, your download folder.
That's right.
Love those.
Yeah. So I think at some level that's going to be the side effect of some of the unusability that some of us are complaining about. We'll end up with another form of a tax surface, but hopefully one that is a little bit more robust than the ones that we have today.
Yeah. Well, something else interesting. Now, before I forget, we've had a number of people ask about how to comment and how to feedback. And, you know, partially because I'm so anti-clickbait economy, this podcast has never had a hit like and subscribe and, you know, click your heels three times together and give us 4 stars or whatever it's going to be. We don't waste time on any of that kind of stuff. And we don't say, whenever I post these things on LinkedIn, I never say, do you have an opinion about passkeys? Let us know by clicking below. You know, people will if they want. I'm not going to do some insincere outreach. But what if people actually do want to talk to us? I think on the LinkedIn for the adversarial podcast, but in comments on that, let's just funnel people that way right now if you want to. One option, and I'm getting towards a security-related topic, I promise. One option that was on the table initially would have been on our YouTube. And by the way, we have a YouTube. We realize a lot of people didn't realize that. There's a video version of this if you're listening on audio. On the YouTube.
And Sunil and Jerry are good-looking folks. I'm a little hard on the eyes, so, but...
a little hard on the eyes? Faces for radio. Yeah. So on the YouTube, technically, you could comment there, right? And people love that. I turned off the commenting on YouTube, and the reason why is really interesting. So every time we would post a YouTube video, I, as the admin, would get, and by the way, if you're not like, you know, triggering on that, and that's not your recon that Jerry's the admin on this whole thing and fishing me for it, then come on, you're going to try. But I gave it away. So as the admin, I would always get a comment that basically sounded like, hey, can you help me out? The idea was like, I'm so, such a neophyte and so dumb at this cryptocurrency thing that I need help recovering my wallet. Here's the passphrase that I was asked to generate at the beginning of it. Maybe if I give this to you, you could help me out. Which looks like somebody disclosing their, you know, the keys to the kingdom right away. And so I talked with a good security friend. I'm pretty sure it was Guillaume Ross on this. And he either knew or was able to find pretty quickly how this whole thing plays out. And the idea is that you would see this as an unscrupulous host or another anybody else looking at the comments and say, oh, this idiot's opening up their wallet. I'm going to go raid the wallet. And you'd go in there and take control of the wallet. And in order to move funds out of the wallet, you had to pay some gas fees, which is a fraction of that. And through a pretty cool, let's say, sleight of hand, the adversary would actually redirect those fees right away. So the money would never move out of that wallet, but they would just capture that little bit of gas fee. And so technically, it's kind of vigilantism, right? Because they're only stealing from people who thought were going to steal from them. So we turned off the comments outright. I think that was the right move. Psychologically, how interesting is that? That they think there's enough people out there who in the anonymous world of internet think it's okay to just prey on someone and steal from their wallet because they were so stupid they leaked the passkey. Is that reality?
Okay, so honor amongst thieves or something like that comes to mind here. But what I thought was most instructive out of this is recognizing that you could have multi-sig wallets. Multi-sig wallets mean multi-signature wallets where you have essentially like two people who can authorize a transaction. So that was actually part of the trick here, that you try to use this wallet, you try to move the money, you pay the gas fee, you authorize it, but you don't realize it's a multi-signature wallet that requires authorization from a second party. So this points out what I think at the end is a nice safeguard for your own wallet. Maybe have a multi-signature wallet of your own. Now, of course, that increases your potential loss of that wallet because now you need to make sure you maintain two keys. But if you're that paranoid about someone stealing your wallet, then you know that's another consideration as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, on-chain multi-sig, I loved from the early days. I thought that was one of the coolest thing about blockchain technology, mm-hmm. without a doubt. All right, bringing us home. You know, we get into a lot of the technical bits around cybersecurity, but I think if you ask any CISO, especially enterprise CISO, what their biggest challenges are, human resources comes into that early on. And I don't mean HR policy, but retaining and recruiting talent in the cybersecurity realm. And so we had a colleague in a Slack ask a really good question among CISOs of what works workshopping-wise, discussion, and so on, when you're having offsites, like an annual thing with direct reports, and made me just think about organizational behavior and like what kind of how you instill culture and how you retain people. So I thought it'd be fun to go around the horn a little bit and talk pretty quickly around like what has worked for you as a security leader in the past for either of you to go.
So I think from the standpoint of the most effective offsites that I've had, so first of all, let's recognize that these offsites are very valuable time. We don't get a chance to take a step away from the day to day and to focus on your leadership team. What is effectively, at least for us as the leader, we have our second team, and for our second team to consider their own first team, you know, their peers and whatever. But the times when I've seen I'll give you an example of cases where I think the time has been wasted, which points to, I think, what is more effective. When you bring these people together, these valuable and the valuable time that they have, I think it's best to make sure that you focus on process. What is the processes, the management processes that you have that helps you become a more effective team? It's a team gathering, not an individual gathering. It's a team gathering, so you have to understand what makes you truly a team. If you end up focusing on complaining about technology or complaining about specific people, like let's say you just had you're doing a performance reviews and you just talk about each person or a person or whatever else it is, then I think you're wasting your time. You're not having the opportunity to talk about your team processes as a whole. And that's the only thing that can really happen when you get the whole team together. You can't talk about team processes in isolation. You have to do it as a group. And that's the most effective use of these leadership offsite gatherings.
You know, I've often don't appreciate these offsite things myself, but I always come back out of them and find them, well, at least the good ones, that, you know, I actually learned something. It was a good experience and I'm better for it. So creating that atmosphere, that environment to do that is really important. And for my suggestion, I like to take myself out of there, right? So I'll go to those offsites, but when people are going to talk about solving problems, especially I think about my threat detection team and my incident response team. And there's always tension between these two, right? Because the threat detection team is trying to come out with the right kind of alert, Jerry. Yeah, I know some of these alerts take time to go build. But the incident response people think it's a waste. It's too verbose, or it's a nothing burger. And I like to have them in one room and have them work together and find a solution, but not me, with me being in that room. I feel that when the leader is there, there's a natural tension to maybe reserve things or try to outdo each other to get the attention of the leader. Just pull yourself out of there. Set the right stage, get them to go work on a solution, and then present some solutions for you at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think there's, I wouldn't say unequivocal, but I think most people agree that when you go into an organization, establishing rapport is really valuable, right? And like as a security leader, for example, as a CISO at a new company, I think you need to spend one-on-one time with the key executives around the company. Until you've met the GC face-to-face, the things you're willing to bring up, the times when you're, the threshold for lifting up the phone, for any of that is completely off the charts. And once you establish that rapport, you're quicker to do it. You can, and then over time, you just start to not even need to waste your time picking up the phone because you already know how they would feel about it. Even getting into social engineering, like, oh, you know, Jane would never have done that. I know her now. And I find it's really true on the teams, like down to the SOC teams. And I would always tell people, I had this silly little like soft skills slide that I would do for new hires. And I would say a ticket from a stranger is an opportunity to get to meet someone. Or likewise, if you detect it, if CrowdStrike says, hey, somebody has Nmap, say the last thing you want to do is burn Nmap off of there. you want to call that person up and get to know them, because that's your total force multiplier in the field. You want to know the people who know what Nmap is in your organization, without a doubt. Similarly, I think certainly with remote first orgs today, where people haven't met at all, even within a security team, but even for in-person teams who are only working day in and day out, the offsite allows you to establish rapport. And instead of just like, hey, we found this alert, what are you doing about it? That's where you finally have the chance to say, like, how about those damn alerts? Yeah, how do you feel about alerts? You know? And so I think the actual agenda isn't super critical. Like, you don't have to solve problems in an offsite per se, but you do want topics that are going to open up candid, sincere discussions and kind of drive people into divulging the way that they feel about things. And because it's all about, you want to leave there with a lot more rapport, which will enable you to spend 364 days actually solving problems a lot more efficiently.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I don't like those sessions, though, when they bring you in, they bring different groups, and some consultant tells you to go try to solve this imaginary problem that has nothing to do with. But I guess that helps, because now you get used to working with each other and troubleshooting with each other. I'd rather not do that. I'd rather get into the more specific, go try to work this out, solve it, rather than this generic thing.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Well, a lot of that's also team building, right? Or at least sometimes when it's not directly just tied to some lecture or whatever. You all are, of course, familiar with my cyber defense matrix, where I put people, process, and technology at the bottom. And one of the questions I oftentimes get is, what exactly is this process thing that you have at the bottom? Like, what is that? What is that? And how do you allocate budget for that? Well, let me offer. These gatherings, these offsites, that is all about process, which is why I was hitting upon that earlier. The time that you spend at these gatherings as a team is really to focus on how do you build the right kind of processes, and how do you know that the processes that you have today are working. That's an investment in process, which is as important, if not, it's as important as the technology and the people side of the equation.
I think it's more important.
I'll say they're equally important. However, it's also underinvested.
Yes.
I just think technology changes all the time. And if you can learn how to work and how to develop these processes to grow with newer technologies, I think it helps out. I think you're right, Sunil.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, great, guys. This was fun. I'm going to rush home and get some sledding time in here in Atlanta with the kids. I'm looking forward to it. Good to see you guys, as always. This was a lot of fun. And let's stay in touch here and gather some new topics. As I directed people earlier, if they want to check out the LinkedIn account for Adversarial Podcast and throw in any ideas on there, then we could always entertain them. Thanks a lot, guys.